President Trump, why do you believe it's appropriate to weigh in on the racial identity of your opponent?
I read where she was not black, and then I read that she was black.
Vice President Harris.
We have someone who wants to be president who has consistently attempted to use race to divide. And I think the American people want better than that, want better than this. We all have dreams and want a president who invests in those, not in hate and division.
I'm Kamala Harris, candidate for president, and I approve this message.
Paid for by Harris for President.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Maybe you've been thinking about therapy. You realize a therapist could help you work things out, but
I can't afford it. Therapy is expensive.
Talkspace is different. Talkspace is one of only a few online mental health providers that takes insurance. Average copays are only $15.
I can afford $15.
And most insured members pay nothing.
Nothing? No copays at all? With insurance, I could see a therapist and I might not have to pay anything out of pocket?
That's right. Nothing should stand in your way of getting support from a caring, licensed therapist. And if you don't have insurance, no problem. You can pay out of pocket for a lower cost than in-person therapy. And because you meet your therapist online, you can schedule appointments for whenever and wherever it's most comfortable for you.
Wow, I'm feeling better already.
You can pay for Talkspace with insurance or get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back to another episode of the Crossover Podcast. Glad you could join me this week. Got a good show lined up for you here. Dan Wojcicki is the senior NBA writer with the LA Times. I've got a lot to get into with Dan. We've got the Michael Jordan documentary starting to wind down. Two really good episodes this past weekend. We dive into that. Plus, Adam Silver had a conference call with some of the players on Friday. What came out of that call and what was said that might give us some sense of direction about where the NBA is going to go for the rest of this season. So stick around for that. Really good episode with Dan Wojcicki. Quick housekeeping note, if you like this podcast, one easy way you can support it, head over to Apple Podcasts, post a comment, leave a rating. It's simple, it's easy, it's free. It's the best way to make sure that we keep doing this podcast week after week. That's it. All right, let's go. All right, joining me now on the podcast from his estate in Los Angeles, the well-groomed, mustached, venerable LA Times NBA writer, Dan Wojcicki. I mean, I'm looking at you now, Dan, and like, this is what quarantine, like, this is basically what quarantine looks like. If there was a picture of quarantine in the dictionary, this face would probably be next to it, if possible.
Not just quarantine, probably some other words too. You know, I think, so my wife and I have had arguments about this mustache. This is my third time trying to grow it. Yeah. Like during quarantine, like it's already been shaved twice. And each time it comes back like 4 to 5% stronger. It's sort of like how Jordan got eliminated. My mustache is sort of like Jordan being eliminated in the playoffs early in his career. This has got, it's got to get over the humps to come back even better. And like this morning, she's like, it's got to go. And I'm like, I've dug my heels in on this. And I'm like, I like it. I want to be able to remember quarantine by something like photographically so we can show like my kid, like, look at how creepy your dad was for 6 months in 2020. It feels important to have some sort of like, you have shaved your head. I am not going to shave my head. This little sort of caterpillar underneath my nose is kind of my visual homage to the experience that we're dealing with.
You know, it's funny, like over the weekend, looking at everybody's Mother's Day, you know, pictures, you see like fathers with mustaches, and my father had a mustache back in the day. At some point, the mustache was actually considered a good look. And right now, like I could count on one hand the number of people that can pull it off. Like Tom Selleck can pull it off. That might be it. I mean, you can't pull it off. Like, that's
Did you see Kyle Kuzma's mustache recently?
Yes. He can't pull it off either. Like, that's...
He looked like a Cuban band leader.
That's harsh. That's a harsh
look. I mean, that's what he... I mean, it was great. I thought it was awesome. I mean, he looked like he was in the Buena Vista Social Club. I really liked it. No, I mean, I think, like, at a certain point, right, like, people decided that mustaches were creepy, you know, and I think the creeps won. Like, they've won the mustache. It's, I'm trying to think of, like, who's the last great NBA player? I mean, Michael Jordan had a mustache for a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, like, a real like, they have to go to, like, Kurt Rambis. Like, didn't he have the...
Blake Griffin briefly had a mustache. He looked hilarious.
Those were more like, I mean, you have to go to the people that actually, you have to get back to the 70s and 80s to find like a consistent, like a guy that just has a mustache, like who just, this is my look, not something I'm experimenting with.
I mean, can you imagine like Steve Kerr with just like a bushy mustache, like how different of a career he would have?
Yes. I don't know. I don't know how different it would be at this point.
Like if Jordan went to hit him and he hit the mustache and like the fist like bounced off of it because it was so full and lush.
Hey, they do say in boxing you got to shave your face before fights because they look at the facial hair as being protection from contact. So
wait, they make you shave your face?
Most states make you shave your face, yeah, because it's viewed as correctly in some ways. Like a big James Harden type beard would presumably protect the guy that's hitting the jaw. No,
like Mike Woodson would have like an amazing chin.
Yeah, he'd have a granite chin. Like some of these guys that can grow their beards out. Be impressive. James Harden, be a great boxer. You mentioned the documentary, mm-hmm. and we went through episodes 7 and 8 this past weekend. It's been really well done. I mean, you have to, of course, look at this through the lens of what Michael Jordan wants you to see. There's a lot of stuff there that's clearly very slanted towards Jordan. But look, they got into the stuff last night that was maybe the meatier stuff in Jordan's career. And I thought what was... I don't want to call it interesting at this point, but like I was glad that they touched on the idea that Jordan was suspended because of gambling back in 1993, that his hiatus into baseball was nothing more than a 18-month suspension by David Stern for whatever gambling problems that Jordan allegedly had. I mean, were you ever a conspiracy theorist there, Dan, with the Jordan suspension?
Yeah. So backstory on this, right, is so I grew up in Chicago. I was I was in my mandatory band class when Michael Jordan retired, like during the press conference, and like nobody played music that day. Like because we were all so sad. No one, not a trombone was picked up that day in Chicago. No.
The day the music died.
No, they had us all like, you know, we went and just listened to the radio, Chris. You know, we didn't have a TV in our classroom. But it was that big of a deal. I always, you know, tied it directly to the death of his father. And sort of that, in my kind of, you know, early teen mind, it just assumed to me, it had occurred to me that, you know, that's why. And then when he comes back, he wears 45 is because, you know, he didn't want to play in 23. That was his dad. That was their bond. And I think, you know, the gambling stuff was always... It was there because it was such a big story in the months kind of preceding both the murder of his father and his retirement that, like, I do remember wondering about that stuff and wondering if it was all tied together because how could you not, I think. But I do think with sort of the hindsight of kind of clarity, you know, I mean, like, David Stern loved promoting stars, right? Like, loved it. And I think part of promoting stars is you would rather have Michael Jordan play in your finals than saying, like, he's going to be mad probably because this, but like, you know, Vernon Maxwell and the Knicks, right? And those games, like the star wattage goes so far down. So, you know, kind of the idea that, yeah, you're, and also, by the way, does anybody believe that Michael Jordan stopped betting when he came back in 1996? Like, no, like, absolutely not. So I think those two things kind of combine. Kind of, you know, blow that conspiracy out of the water in my mind. Also, by the way, everybody talks in the NBA. We would have heard this way more concretely in the you know, the 20 years since or whatever, however.
Yeah, I mean, to your point about David Stern promoting stars, I mean, David Stern became commissioner in the early 1980s, and it was his mandate, his drive to grow the NBA, and he did it in part by saying it's not Lakers versus Celtics, it's Bird versus Magic. It's yep. not Pistons versus Bulls, it's Isaiah versus Jordan. Like, he as much as anyone emphasized the individualism of basketball. So the idea, like, Michael Jordan would have had to have been betting against the Bulls. You know, he would have had to have been betting against his own team, in my opinion, for David Stern to suspend him for any length of time from basketball. It just, you could, there aren't enough casinos in the country that Michael Jordan could have visited as a legal enterprise that would have pushed David Stern from pushing the biggest star in basketball out of the league for 2 years. And look, I think that his ultimate decision to retire was probably, look, the death of his father was probably the last straw, right? Like, that was probably yeah. the straw that broke the camel's back. Like, it was the gambling stuff, the being burnt out, and then you get to the offseason. He accomplished what Larry and Magic never did, which was win three straight. You know, he felt like a sense of accomplishment. He felt a lot of pressure and criticism from people, and then his father passes, and that was just too much. Maybe he would have done it anyway, Dan, but I think that was what pushed him over the line and led to that retirement.
Well, I think one of the things the documentary has done, and it succeeded in this, is like try to get you a sense of like the burden of being Michael Jordan, right? And I've rolled my eyes at some of that stuff in terms of like, oh, it's so hard to be famous. And like, you know, I mean, look, he is responsible for Be Like Mike. He is responsible for being in all of these commercials and selling Hanes and Ballpark Franks and stuff like that. Like, he didn't have to do this stuff, right? Like, he was a willing participant. He cashed those checks. He showed up in those commercials. That all being said, you know, this was like, I think younger people have to, like, the level of fame that Michael Jordan had, like, it was totally normal for him to put his name on, like, cologne in the mid-90s, right? Like, that was, like, not, like, nobody really people were excited about it. Like, can you imagine if, like, LeBron James or, like, Kevin Durant cologne was a thing right now? Like, how just dragged through the internet they would be? I mean, he was Krusty the Clown in terms of marketing. I think, you know, and these things do have costs. And I think we see in these episodes kind of like, yeah, like him being an a-hole and being so driven and pushing and pushing and pushing. Like, people always talk about like Michael Jordan's sort of infinite energy, right? Like, this guy could go play golf or play cards till, you know, 5 in the morning or play 36 holes before a game and then go crush it. Like, nobody has infinite energy. Everybody has a point where that tank goes empty. And I think Jordan's tank went empty a bunch of times. I mean, like, you know, he has won 6 titles and has 3 retirements. You know, like, he's set all sorts of NBA records. Is there another player that's retired more times than Michael Jordan?
No. I mean, he retires more than boxers do. And I've seen boxers retire a lot.
He's like,
come back.
He's like, Hop. He's like Bernard.
He's like B-Hop. B-Hop retired at 40 once and then kept going until he was in his 50s. One of the great what-ifs, though, Dan, with that documentary, which I kind of picked up on after the fact, was, you know, if the 1995 baseball strike doesn't happen, does any of this, like, it seemed like the White Sox were ready to move Jordan up to AAA, at least, you know, at that year. Maybe he gets on to the major leagues at some point later in the year. Like, does he still come back if there isn't a strike that forces him, you know, kind of out of the game?
I think he does. And I think there's a little, like, tiny little Easter egg in the clip. So that, you know, they show the Bulls being eliminated by the Knicks in that playoff series, and they kind of cut to the Barons locker room, right? And you see Jordan kind of watching it on this, like, 10-inch sort of TV in the corner of the room. And he's talking about how, oh, I wish I could just go watch it. I'm watching it only as a fan and stuff like that. Hanging over his shoulder are the UNC practice basketball shorts that, like, he, like, legendarily wore underneath his uniform and stuff like that, right? And, like, there they are, the basketball shorts. Like, are still a part of him. Basketball is absolutely 100% still a part of him. It is this amazing gift and calling that he had. And I also think too, like, while he is a worker, he's also not the most patient person in the world too. And I think sort of the idea to go through 1500 at bats in the minor leagues to become a 220 major league hitter. I don't think that's, and I mean, he was essentially a slap hitter, right? Like, yeah. He had 3 home runs that year. Like, it wasn't like he had a lot of pop. To become that, I think at some point, quitting isn't the right word, but he would have leaned into sort of, I think, more of his natural kind of inclinations. It's an interesting question though, because, not only in the documentary doesn't talk about this, after that double A season, he goes to the Arizona Fall League, which is like where all the top prospects go and stuff like that. And he hits 250 at the Arizona Fall League. Now he struck out a ton. But, against a higher level of competition, he was producing and he was getting better. And I think, the LA Times, we had a great story by Bill Shaken. He talked to a scout and kind of compared him to Tebow, and is like, who's like the more realistic prospect? And it's Jordan by a lot. And I think the notion of, again, somebody not playing baseball for over a decade, walking into double A and hitting 200, and people will laugh at that. Like, it is pretty incredible to do it. The natural sort of talent, the natural sort of ability combined with his maniacal work ethic. But ultimately, I don't think he could have ever been the great or the champion that he was in basketball. And also in baseball, you can't carry dudes the way you can carry them in basketball. And I think, Jordan enjoyed being, in his words, the lead dog. Like, he enjoyed that. And I don't think you can – it's way harder to do in baseball.
Yeah, no, I agree. And, that competitive itch to be great, it afflicts everyone, certainly to guys that have been great. There's only so much of being very average to below average you're going to be able to take before you go, when you have the option of going back to being great once again. So maybe it would have happened on a different timeline, but I agree with you. I think he would have eventually come back. All right, let me ask you about some of the news we've got this week. And look, news is somewhat hard to come by during this pandemic, but we do have a call between Adam Silver and the players on Friday. And I've talked to a few people about that call, and one of my big takeaways, Dan, is that in the aftermath of that call, I got the sense that you're going to get the NBA doing quite literally whatever it takes to finish the season. Like, if this thing has to be stretched into late September, early October, they're willing to do it. There just doesn't seem to be any type of urgency right now to set a start date on the 2020-2021 season. And if there isn't that urgency, and if you feel like so many in the league office feel, that the longer you wait to start next season, the more likely it is you're going to get fans back in the stands, then you can just take your time and be patient with this. And I've been reporting for the last couple of weeks, like, all right, June 1st, they want to make a call. Then I was told a week or so back, June 15th, they want to make a call. Then I was told, we can push it even further. Like, I'm not sure there is a date, Dan, where they're going to say, we're done. Like, I think it's going to... As long as there are incremental improvements, I feel like the NBA is going to kick the can down the road a little bit. That to me was my big takeaway from hearing about that call. I mean, you've read it, you've talked to people about it. Like, what were your takeaways?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of am with you. I mean, I think, the June 1st date was always an interesting date because, as far as, and I've reported this, like, they could have come back on June 1st and they could have finished an 82-game regular season schedule, conducted a full-on playoff, and been in business to go, almost even on time next year, right? Like, so I think they view this as they have time. That's not kind of the issue here. The issue isn't, oh, we need to get back to, in 2 weeks because our guys are chomping at the bit. It's like, no, they've been very, I think, pragmatic about this. And I think two things, Chris. Like, A, they don't want to come back and stop again, right? So, like, if they want to be able to get to a position where they can come back, almost like this UFC card this past weekend, where it's like you come back, somebody tests positive. Because look, they're going to come back and someone is going to test positive. Like, there's no question about that, right? Unless they discover some sort of magic vaccine, somebody will get it. And What needs to happen is they need to be able to treat that almost like, and it's obvious it's more serious, but like an injury where it's like, okay, someone gets it, like that player is not available to you. But that doesn't mean we shut it all down, you know, and I think there's still work to do to get to that. I think there's also the other kind of big sort of impediment to the NBA coming back is sort of the social responsibility and the social costs of doing what would it take to put this on. And that means taking over huge chunks of whether it's Las Vegas or Disney. It means tons and tons of testing, tons and tons of processing. And, you know, there, I talked to one executive about this a couple weeks ago for a story I wrote. And this person was like, look, we could have the test tomorrow. Like, we have the money. Like, that's not the issue. The issue is, you know, can you get the test? And can your parents get the test? And can, you know, and can their neighbors get the tests? And until those answers are more consistently yes, I think that's another impediment. But I
do think, Dan, let me jump in. I do think that on that issue, the NBA has quietly kind of moved the goalpost up a little bit. Like, the fact that they're going to allow asymptomatic testing,
yep,
tells me that, like, before I would think that they're not going to do something like this, where you're right. I mean, one thing people need to understand, the NBA can get the tests. Like, they can just buy them. Like, it's not an issue for them to get their hands on 10,000, 15,000 tests. They're going to be able to do it. Initially, I thought they wouldn't do it until, like, and I'm just, this is kind of making this up, but like, all the governors said, we got enough. Like, we're good. Everything is good. Now, I think as long as things are trending in a direction, they're willing to do it. And I think that asymptomatic testing and their willingness to let Orlando and what is it, LA at this point do it, that tells me that they're going to be a little looser with their guidelines on return.
I view that as almost like sort of a, like a little bit of a test to see how the public would respond. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, when you're worried about optics and when you're worried about responses of people, you know, there was initial backlash to a team like the Los Angeles Lakers taking a bunch of tests very early in this process, right? A lot of asymptomatic players at a time when, you know, people in LA County, it was hard, really, really hard to get a test. And that was done through a private, you know, a private firm and stuff like this. This is all stuff that, you know, kind of in their planning for this, that the league sort of mandated teams have these contingencies in place and they put them in place. I think that it felt to me like a little bit of a trial balloon on this to see kind of how people would react. And largely, I think people kind of didn't really react, which is good news for the NBA in that sense. Now, you know, we're talking about a couple places, and I think it helps that in LA right now, Chris, that, you know, if you live in LA County, you can make an appointment and get a test. It's free. Like, that's something that LA County residents have access to. You know, I think that makes it a lot easier. My wife is an emergency room nurse in Los Angeles, and, you know, she is being tested and she has access to this type of stuff. So I think if, you know, the league were to procure 15,000 tests, I think it wouldn't be like something like she wouldn't be outraged by it at this point. A month ago, I think she would have been outraged, you know? And so I do think this feels like a little bit of trouble. But one thing, Chris, with this is I feel like every time we've moved an inch closer to playing, it feels like people think we're moving a mile. Mm-hmm. And this is still, I'm drawn to the release the Toronto Raptors sent out last week of all of the like contingencies in place to put one person in the gym at a time. You know, it was like a 600 word list of precautions, right? And things. And this was to get one person in the gym for jump shots. You know, this isn't two on two, three on three, four on four, five on five. Like, it still feels like, I mean, there are some really, really big hurdles to cross. And, you know, yeah, it's positive that we are taking these little steps and maybe those little steps will turn into a jog at some point and then eventually a run and a sprint. But it does still feel like these are little tiny kind of like the early stages of like learning how to walk type steps.
Well, and I think too that you mentioned the UFC this past weekend, and on a smaller scale, I do think that can offer a type of blueprint, especially when it comes to how they handled a positive test. I mean, how UFC handled the positive test to one of its fighters and the two trainers that work with that fighter is kind of exactly what the league has been discussing. You don't shut it down. You remove the athlete from the equation. You quarantine them and you go on with the show. Now, maybe the NBA would move a little more gradually with their event. Maybe they would have pushed a game back a couple of days to make sure everybody was clean after that, not just go right into the UFC event the next day. But there has to come a point where you don't shut it down if somebody tests positive. Like, you can't, if somebody tests positive on the Lakers, you can't pull the entire Laker team out of it. And for the players, they've got to assume a measure of risk. Like, there just isn't going to be a day, not in the next probably year. I'm just going to, like, at least 9 months, if not a year, where you're 100% sure you're going to be fine. Like, it's just, it's a reality that you have to deal with.
I mean, that's the other key, right, too, in terms of, and it's not just in the NBA, but again, it's societal, is what is acceptable risk here? And how do we move towards it, and how do we move forwards once we kind of accept these risks? And I mean, I think we've seen societally, obviously, people getting a little more restless with stuff, saying like, yeah, we'll take on the risks, and it's still not a majority. But I mean, eventually, as this goes on longer and longer, there will be more people that are willing to take on more of a risk. And I think once again, society gets to a point where, yeah, like you might get this. You're probably going to be okay, and but you might get it, and you might not. Is it worth it to you? I think if once those answers become more yes and yes across the board societally, it'll be easier for the NBA to come back. Now, look, obviously, the NBA does not want to be in a position where they come back and, God forbid, a player or a coach, you know, and I mean, it could be a player. I mean, there are players that have, you know, asthma. There are players that have, you know, medical issues and stuff like that, and compromised immune systems. Like, this is in the league. There are coaches that for sure have this, officials, et cetera, people that will be around the game. Like, the NBA absolutely, I mean, at its core, like, doesn't want to be in a position where you're risking people's lives. Like, it would be a stain on the league that I think would be so hard to come back from, right? As if you come back and because you're trying to satisfy TV dates or whatever, if you come back and, God forbid, somebody dies, like, I mean, that would be hard for people to forget about that, I think. So you have to move with a caution on this, but you also, you know, 0% risk isn't a realistic situation until there's a vaccine. And even still, that's not a realistic risk. I think what the NBA has done and what society at large has done is, like, we bought people more time, so there's better treatment options, and we have a slightly better, if it's a 5% better understanding of the virus or 7% better understanding of the virus that we did the day Rudy Gobert tested positive, people are more equipped to deal with it. But again, it's going to be something that's going to have to be dealt with. It's not going to be something that can just go away. And so I think, you know, the NBPA, and I've heard this from executives and stuff, say that, like, coming to grips with that is going to be a real challenge for people. But they're going to have to come to grips with it, because otherwise they're not coming back.
You know, the other thing I wonder about is, you know, they're basically going to have to create a new collective bargaining agreement. Like Adam Silver said, look, our CBA is not built to withstand this type of pandemic. Yeah. And I wonder how challenging that is. I mean, you and I have both covered these negotiations in the past. I mean, some have been tamer than others, but others have been knockdown, drag out wars, you know, between the PA and the NBA. Now, Adam Silver and Michelle Roberts seem like they've got a really good relationship. Chris Paul and Adam Silver have a good relationship. So maybe that greases the skids a little bit. But, you know, ultimately everything comes down to money, right? Now, I do wonder, you know, how players accept. You know, I think Silver was trying to, like, let them know exactly by saying that 40% of the revenue comes from the gate, which surprised me a little bit. I didn't think it was that much that comes from fan revenue. But to say 40% of it, that to me was Adam Silver's message to players that, fellas, like, your salaries are going to come down. Everything is coming down significantly. So gear up for it. Here's a big number I'm throwing at you. Start to, you know, equate that into your brain and understand that's what's going to happen.
Well, and I think too, right, is sort of the, to this point, people have operated with sort of the notion that that 40% would come back, right? That at some point it will just be like it was, and it might not, Chris, like we don't know, you know? And I think the NBA has done a good job of being the sort of, we don't know league. And that's where it gets so tricky in terms of coming up with some sort of collective bargaining agreement, because so much of that is projecting into the future and projecting sort of what the league is going to look like in a year or 2 years. And I mean, I don't know. I don't think they know. I don't think they can know.
How can they? Yeah. How can they?
And so trying to figure out a way of, I mean, you know, you do the best you can. What does an NBA look like that is based solely on television revenue? You know, what do salaries look like when it's only the TV deal? You know, that's going to be something that, you know, and it's not only, there'll be merchandising, but like even like merchandising will be way down. There's, you know, we're at the highest level of unemployment in this country, you know, in generations. That's less money to buy jerseys. That's less money to buy T-shirts. Even if you open the doors to fans, it's less people that are there to buy tickets. Ticket prices might be too high. Hot dogs might be too expensive. Beers might be too expensive. They are too expensive.
Damn it.
You know. So like all of these things are going to have to be recalibrated possibly, and it's going to wreak financial havoc on the league. And I do think that of all of, and this is maybe a little bit of an NBA bias, but I do feel like of all the pro sports leagues, one thing, and credit to Adam Silver on this, is they do feel the most sort of adaptable and the most sort of like ready to put a foot in the ground and pivot and do something slightly different. If they have to, whether that means less games, doing stuff for TV, more driven TV, miking players, whatever it does to make the product what it needs to be, airing, you know, maybe they air, you know, a game with player with in an empty arena with players mic'd on ESPN, and maybe on ESPN News, there's that same product on a delay that's edited. You know what I mean? Audio. Like, I mean, they are open to ideas, and I feel like this is a time for ideas.
No, and look, Adam Silver has said that to his general managers. Like, he told the GMs on a call, like, bring me your best ideas. Like, he's basically crowdsourcing how you handled this. And look, I never feel bad for owners. I mean, I do believe that owning an NBA team is idiot proof. Like, the CBA kind of made it as much. That being said, like, a lot of these owners own these buildings too, and these buildings aren't getting crowds back for anything anytime soon. So if you're a, you know, somebody like a Joe Tsai and you're owning the Barclays Center, like, it could be a year before you see concerts in there. You're not going to see any type of revenue overall. That's why I think that circles it back to the CBA discussions. Like, I think owners are going to draw a hard line on some stuff. Like, I think they're going to say, look, we're rich, but we ain't that rich, and we're going to be losing more money than you guys over the next larger percentage of money over the next year plus. Because I don't really believe, and look, this is all speculation at this point, but based on what we know about the availability of a vaccine, and of course, when a vaccine becomes available, it's not a light switch. Like, you don't take the vaccine like you're taking like a Tylenol, and boy, I'm all of a sudden, you know, ready to go back out there and rejoin crowds.
Too, Chris, that's the other thing too, right? Yes. It's like you also have to produce said vaccine once you have it. Like, for
the
social issues again that deal with the testing are going to apply to the vaccine. Like, mm-hmm. The NBA won't buy the first 700 vaccines.
Could you imagine that? Like, it comes over from like the UK. It's like, no, we got them. We got them here. Let's
That's not
send it to Memphis. Send it to Memphis first.
That won't happen. So yeah, no, I think you're right. Yeah. I mean, it seems to me like, Chris, like some sort of like bridge agreement that offers tons of fluidity seems like kind of the necessary kind of agreement. But again, like, getting to those agreements is going to be hard. Like, that's not going to be an easy thing. But I do think that there does at least feel it, and this is a good starting point, is that it's all coming from a place of like, we don't know what's happening. And I think once, if everybody is on that page, then you can move forwards. If you have to convince people that, no, you're not really losing money, or no, this isn't like, this is going to be a blip in the radar for you. You'll be fine in 5 months. You know, Joe Tsai, for instance, crying poor isn't going to, like, it's not going to ring true to anybody. But I do think that as, you know, players and owners and stuff look out in this world and see it changing at warp speed over this and see things like unemployment numbers do what they do and stuff like that, there does feel like at least a sliver of altruism in this and kind of a feeling to, like, let's figure something out because it's important that we do.
Yeah, I agree with that. We'll see. Certainly a lot we still have to learn over the next couple of months. Dan, always appreciate it, man. Keep up the good work with the mustache and also, you know, your work with the LA Times.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for that. Yeah, my career, my other real job.
Appreciate it, man.
No problem.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.